We've been journeying through the Bible for the last few, for the last few weeks or the last year and a half, right? So back in 2023, we started our journey through the Bible, and we, in the first section, the first collection of books in the Bible, which is the Old Covenant or the Old Testament, and that's the Hebrew story, so we've been going through that, and we have found ourselves in a series within that that we've been calling Thrones. And Thrones is the study of the period of the Bible, of the Old Testament, where we are dealing with the kingdom of Israel. Remember this, the Israelites came out of slavery. They came to the promised land. They established themselves there. Eventually, they became a kingdom. And then after their third king, which was Solomon, after Solomon passed away, the kingdom was divided for good into the north and the south. The northern kingdom is called Israel. Southern kingdom is called Judah. And the two never came back together, and that's what we've been studying under our long mini-series called Thrones. And the northern kingdom is gone. There is no more northern kingdom. We saw a few weeks ago their demise. That is now the land of Samaria. That's all that's left. But the south is still around for another week. Next week, we're going to see the end of the south, okay? This series, Thrones, comes to an end next Sunday, okay? And we'll continue through what's left, not much left in the Old Testament, before we move into Jesus' story just a little further down. We're getting there. We're near the home stretch now. But we're going to cover that next week as we wrap up the Thrones portion. For today, I want to remind you where we were last week. We were in two characters, Hezekiah and Manasseh. Hezekiah was a great king, a reformer, did a great job. At the end of his life, he got a little off course there, which happens so often in the stories we've read. And that's the time when his son was finally born. He had a young son and probably didn't have, the poor kid probably didn't have the best upbringing because of that. But Hezekiah had been a great king, but he finished on a downslope. And his son took the throne, Manasseh. Manasseh was a terrible leader for a long time, weakened the nation spiritually, morally, militarily, and did bad stuff. Eventually was dragged into bondage by the Assyrians and sent to Babylon. And then while imprisoned there, he humbled himself before God, and he turned it around. He turned his story around. He found the Lord for the first time in the lowest spot of his life, which happens so often, right? And it says, the history, some of you who nerd out about such things would care about this. The history tells us that it's around this time that the Assyrian Empire, as we saw recently, was losing its stronghold as a growing empire once their king had been assassinated by his own sons. And so about this time, Babylon, who was a more ancient kingdom anyhow, broke free from Assyria. And during that time, as they began to amass their own power, Manasseh is free to come home and resume his throne in Jerusalem. And when Manasseh comes home, he changes everything. He's a much better king at the end than he was at the beginning. But of course, the damage was mostly done. But he does end well. But when he dies, his son takes the throne. We're going to briefly see his son. And then after, we're going to spend most of our time on one character today. But let's begin with Manasseh's son, Amon. We're going to jump from Chronicles to Kings. Chronicles to Kings, back and forth, because these two sets of books are telling parallel stories, and they give us different details. So we'll begin in 2 Chronicles chapter 33 in verse 21. It says, Amon, that's Manasseh's son, Amon, he was 22 years old when he became king. And he reigned in Jerusalem for just 2 years. That's a short reign. He did what was evil in the Lord's sight, just as his father Manasseh had done in his early reign. He worshipped and sacrificed to all the idols his father had made. Of course, the same mess that had kind of messed up the kingdom before his father was taken into captivity in prison. Verse 23 says, but unlike his father, Amon did not humble himself before the Lord. Instead, Amon sinned even more. So he never had a come to God moment later on. He's just going down the same path that really weakened the nation during his father's most of his reign, but not his father's good ending. And so everyone in the nation's like, oh, great, here we go again. We've been there, done that, bought the T-shirt, have a whole collection of T-shirts from this story. We do not need more. So sure enough, in verse 24, then Amon's own officials conspired against him and assassinated him in his palace. But the people of the land killed all those who had conspired against King Amon, and they made his son Josiah the next king. Interestingly, as history teaches us, people who assassinate a leader always feel justified in their assassination. There's a reason they did it. Whether they had a good reason or not, they always feel they do. But it usually doesn't end well for the assassin. Very seldom. Sometimes it does, but most of the time it does not. And so the assassins did what they did, feeling justified, but the people of the land killed them, and Amon's son becomes king. Now, if you're following the story so far, Amon's 24 years old when he dies. How old can his son be? His son Josiah becomes the throne. He's 24 when he dies. So how old must Josiah be? Like, when I was 24, our firstborn wasn't even born. Our son Brett was born 3 weeks after I turned 25. So if, had I, you know, had someone taken me out for the insurance money at the age of 24, I would have never laid eyes on my son. So how old can Amon's son Josiah be when he dies at 24? Well, the answer is he's eight years old. He's the second youngest king in Israel. The youngest was Joash that Anthony spoke about months ago. Joash was seven. Josiah is going to be an eight-year-old king. Manasseh was 12 years old. They're all pretty young. These are some young kings. But this guy is pretty, he's a kid. Which, by the way, can we just pause and think about Amon? Not only was he a wicked king when he was king for 2 years, but apparently he was a player in high school, okay? Because 16, actually, by the time that Josiah would have been conceived, Amon would have been 15. So what a wild young life he carried on, I guess. He was just a small town dude with a big city attitude or something. I don't know. He was his own person, but anyhow, he is now the king. His son now is now the king. Now, Josiah is a good dude. He's a good dude, and we're going to see his story for the majority. In fact, honestly, Josiah is so epic, he deserves 2 weeks from us, but we're going to give him one. So I'm going to throw a lot at you, but this is a pretty cool reign from front to end. So let's just jump into Josiah's story. Back to 2 Kings for a few minutes, chapter 22 and verse 1. It says, Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem for 31 years. So he did not live a super long life because he started so young. At 39, it would all be over. But of course, he doesn't go on to have a bad stretch like some of his ancestors who were good and then kind of landed poorly. He's good all the way through his, although shortened, life. His mother was Jedidiah, daughter of Adiah from Bozkath. Josiah did what was pleasing in the Lord's sight, and he followed the example of his ancestor David. He did not turn away from doing what was right. Now, a couple things in that verse I want you to notice. The first thing is that he's compared to David. David is always the benchmark, isn't he? In the stories of the kings of Israel, David was not perfect, but David did a lot of epically cool stuff. And even when David got off course for a while, he kind of turned it around at the end, and he just left a legacy that everyone was compared to after him. And Josiah is compared to David as a great king. But with this extra statement that he never turns away in all of his 39 years, his whole life. Well, we're going to skip a few years because let's be honest, when you're 39 years old, I mean, when you're an eight-year-old king, there's not much to talk about in his early reign. We're going to skip ahead to his adulthood because when he's an eight-year-old king, for the next many years, you're probably learning, you know, was it reading, writing, and arithmetic or something? I mean, he's probably just getting educated. And by the time he's a 26-year-old young man and his frontal lobe is fully developed finally, you know, we're going to talk about his kingdom from that point on. So at the age of 26, we pick up the story in verse 3. It says that in the 18th year of his reign, King Josiah sent Shaphan, that's the key guy. It says he's the son of Azaliah, grandson of Meshulam, okay. But he sends Shaphan, the court secretary, to the temple of the Lord. And Josiah told Shaphan, he said, go to Hilkiah the high priest and have him count the money the gatekeepers have collected from the people at the Lord's temple. As people came to worship at the temple, they would sometimes bring, along with their sacrifices, they would bring gifts and offerings and leave some monetary gifts behind at the temple. And apparently they've been storing up that money for a while. And the king, Josiah, says, hey, tell the high priest, as the king, I want to know, how much money have they been storing up over there? What's the surplus in the temple budget right now? Because I need a number. And here's why. Verse 5. Entrust this money to the men assigned to supervise the restoration of the Lord's temple. Then they can use it to pay workers to repair the temple. The temple was not in good shape anymore. Back in King Solomon's day when it was first built, it was so magnificent. It was a wonder of the world, so to speak. People came from far and wide to see this glorious temple in the beautiful city of Jerusalem. But time has worn things down. Kings like Rehoboam and many others have looted the temple of its best products to pay off hostile kings from attacks that were threatening them. Other kings like Ahaz shut the temple down for a while, destroyed its furniture. Other kings like Manasseh repurposed the temple for other reasons. And it has just fallen into disrepair. It's like going to a town that used to be epic and now it's all run down and the storefronts are beat up. The temple was still being used because of people who cared about the spiritual reasons. It just didn't look so good anymore. And so the king is basically like, look, loosen up the purse strings, let's fix the temple. Now, why had they not already done that with the money? It was probably because the king had to say so in the past about what they did with the temple, right? And the previous kings didn't care that much, but Josiah did. Or maybe, you know, the people in charge of that were like, I don't know, we need to keep more cash on hand. And he's like, we got to fix this place. It's in bad shape. He continues, Josiah says in verse 6, they will need to hire carpenters, builders, and masons, also have them buy the timber and the finished stone needed to repair the temple. And this is kind of weird, verse 7, but don't require the construction supervisors to keep account of the money they receive, for they are honest and trustworthy men. I can't even fathom that in this day and age, but okay. So they just collected the money and put it to work with the general contractors. What happens next, I'm afraid if we ever do read through our Bibles, like I hope you all will do at least at some point through these scriptures for yourself. If you read through this, the next thing we are about to read might be something you're tempted to brush over without too much thought, but I want us to notice it because it's really remarkable in a weird, bizarre sort of way. While they're fixing up the temple, while they're restoring this beat up, rundown place, As the months and the weeks and months go by, something weird happens in verse number 8. Hilkiah, the high priest, said to Shaphan, the court secretary for Josiah, hey, I have found the book of the law in the Lord's temple. And then Hilkiah gave the scroll to Shaphan and he read it. He's like, oh, we found something. It's the book of the law. Now, remember what the book of the law is. Well, first of all, the law, as contained in the scriptures, was called the law, was the period that of the books that Moses wrote that told the story of God bringing them out of slavery and giving them laws to live by. Remember, the Israelites, about a thousand years earlier, the Israelites were in slavery, and when they came out of slavery, they had never had to govern themselves before. They were just, when you're a slave, your government is, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, do what you're told. So when they are brought out of slavery, most of them are illiterate. They don't know how to, they just, there's worker bees, now they're free. And so God met with Moses and gave them a whole system of laws by which to govern their nation. Moral laws, what's right, what's wrong. Civil laws, how to settle disputes between people. Judicial laws, how to govern and lead this new nation of people who never had to govern themselves. Health and dietary laws, disease control policies, you name it. A whole system was given to these people to help them figure out how to live independently from the slavery they used to know. And in that law, God gave them a covenant. We use the word covenant. It's like the word contract, but a little bit different for nuance sake. Let's just go with that. The covenant was this. God says, look, I brought you out of slavery because I'm just good like that. You needed it. It was long overdue. I heard your prayer. I brought you out. No strings attached. Now here's the deal. Here's the covenant, if you will believe that I care about you and that I'm good, and put your faith in me, you'll trust me, and follow my ways, follow my best practices that I'm giving you, and live by them, you will prosper because of it. And I'll be with you because, you know, and I'll bless you above and beyond your imagination. But if you kick me to the curb and you don't want my involvement, I won't force myself where I'm not wanted. And while you do that, if you abandon me and then abandon my best practices and weaken yourself, I'll let you do your thing, but it won't end well. It'll end very poorly. In fact, that's all kind of spelled out. And somewhere, this is all written down, and Hilkiah, the high priest, is like, hey, while we're fixing up the temple, we found the book of the law. Now, historians believe the book that they found here was the book of Deuteronomy. We call it Deuteronomy today, which is basically a summary that Moses gave of all that had happened from the beginning, the story, the laws, and the covenant God made. And he says, we found this thing. And I'm thinking, how did you lose that thing? Isn't that kind of the point? I mean, what were you doing in the temple anyhow, you know? Oh, we're just doing temple stuff. You know, I think it's like religions tend to get, just full of traditions. We've done it for years this way. We do our religious stuff this way because that's how we've been doing it for a long time. And we get very defensive for our traditions and don't question our traditions. But we forget the reason behind them all. Like, where did this come from? What's the why behind the what? And apparently they lost the book of the law, but they're just carrying on like nothing's wrong. And so they find it. And the high priest reads it, and he hands it to Shaphan. And Shaphan, he reads it, and he's like, oh, boy. I don't know how long it had been lost for. Was it just their lifetime? Was it generations? I mean, the temple had been in bad shape for a while. Was it under some rubble or behind the scaffolding in the back room? I don't know. But they're like, oh, hey, check this out. Verse number 9, Shaphan went to the king, and he reported, your officials have turned over the money collected at the temple of the Lord to the workers and the supervisors at the temple. The reconstruction's going on. It's great. Oh, and by the way, Shaphan also told the king, Hilkiah the priest has given me a scroll. So Shaphan read it to the king. The king's like a 26 or so-year-old guy, hearing it for the first time as they all were. What was written down almost 1,000 years ago. It says in verse 11, when the king heard what was written in the book of the law, he tore his clothes in despair. When he reads what's in the book, he's like, oh my, have we ever lost the narrative? I mean, what God brought us out of slavery and gave us all this and gave us a pattern to build a kingdom off, and we have just walked completely, we have made a mess. We have pushed him to the side. We've abandoned everything he taught us. We're a mess. In fact, we shouldn't even be here anymore. That's why for generations now we've gotten so weak and so fragile to enemy threats. We're in trouble. And so he's in despair. He's tearing his clothes, and he gathers his people together, and Josiah says, can someone please go find a prophet? I need someone with spiritual clairvoyancy or a vision from God, however you want to word it, a prophecy from God, so we could talk to God about these ancient writings and tell us today, what does God have to say? Are we too late? Is it too late for our kingdom? Have we gone too far? Is there hope? I don't know where we stand. Can someone please find us a prophet? Well, Isaiah, the prophet, is dead. He's gone. Jeremiah, the prophet, we're going to see him. He's a young guy coming up in the ranks right about now. But there was a prophet that everyone heralded very highly. Her name was Huldah. And everyone, she was a powerful prophet that people came to for spiritual guidance and direction and words from the Lord to speak into their lives. And so the king says, go see her. So in 2 Kings 22:14, so Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam, Achbor, Shaphan, and Asaiah went to the new quarter of Jerusalem to consult with the prophet Huldah. She was the wife of Shallum, the son of Tivka, son of Harass, the keeper of the temple wardrobe. So her husband's family was in the business of the temple wardrobe. So apparently the temple, they lost the word of the Lord, but they had the wardrobe game. Their wardrobe game was A+, you know. So anyhow, her husband worked in that was his family's business. But she was a prophet. And people came to her and said, what's God have to say? And she was used to being used by the Lord with her spiritual gifts. However, this time her audience is different. Is Hilkiah the priest, her husband, you know, from the place her husband worked himself? Oh, hey, Hilkiah. And it's the king's key people on behalf of the king coming to see her. So she has a pretty important audience. And they're like, what's going on? What does God have to say? Please tell us. And she gives them no good news. Her answer is, it's too late. for the centuries that have gone by, the nation has weakened itself so much that it's just too, it's beyond hope of, not for individuals, but for the kingdom. The kingdom has just destroyed itself beyond repair. She says, almost like going to the doctor, because you're like, I don't feel well. And they're like, well, you didn't know this, but you've had an underlying condition for a long time. It's terminal. You're not going to live. It's not a matter of if you're going to pass away. It's a matter of when, how long. We can prolong your life a little bit perhaps, but it's terminal. That's kind of what the nation was like here. She says, look, the kingdom is so deteriorated and through its bad direction that it's going to come to an end in the near future. And Babylon, who's rising to prominence right now, is going to come along and rule this area one day. And it's too late. That's some pretty bad news for Josiah. But that's not all she had to say. I want you to see what she says next. In verse 18, Huldah says, but go to the king of Judah, who sent you to seek the Lord, and tell him, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says concerning the message you've just heard. Considering that bad news you just heard, here's what God says to you. You were sorry, and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I said against the city and its people, that this land would be cursed and become desolate. You tore your clothing in despair, and you wept before me in repentance, and I have indeed heard you, says the Lord. Isn't that interesting? Josiah, when he heard how far they've gotten away from God's intentions, he was so tore up that he humbles himself and he prays to God and he tears his clothes and he repents. And some people would say, Josiah, why would you repent? You didn't do anything wrong. Come on now. This was people before you were even alive. It's not your problem. That's what we tend to do, right? That's what people tend to do. So what religious people tend to do is we don't want to own the sins of the fathers before us. I wasn't around for that. So I don't need to be accountable for things that happened before I was born. But Josiah understands that someone's got to step up and say, look, the people who did those wrongs aren't here. If they were, they wouldn't care. But we're here, and this is our story, and someone's got to say, we blew it. We blew it, and I'm going to own it because someone's got to own it, and I'm sorry. And he repents on behalf of them all, even though the young king himself was a good guy. And so Huldah, she says, listen, God sees that. And while the nation is on a track towards certain destruction, God's heard your prayer and has seen your heart, and he's pleased with you. Verse 20. So I will not send the promised disaster until after you have died and have been buried in peace. You will not see the disaster I'm going to bring on this city. In other words, in your lifetime, it's going to stay good, and you're going to die in peace, in a time where the kingdom is still intact, and they are going to honor you and sing, and celebrate your life and mourn your death before the bad stuff happens. So don't worry, it'll come after your life is over. So they took her message back to the king. Now, what's the king do with that information? Well, if he's like his great-grandfather Hezekiah, he would say, good. As long as there's peace in my day, who cares, right? That's what Hezekiah said. But that's not what Josiah says. Josiah has a whole different outlook on the fact that it's hopeless in the long run, but it's going to be good during his day. So, hey, I can't change it anyhow. Just eat and drink and be merry. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. I mean, it's over. Why try? That's not what Josiah does. Let's read that story back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34. It says, then the king summoned all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem, and the king went up to the temple of the Lord with all the people of Jerusalem and Judah, and all the priests and Levites, all the people from the greatest to the least. He gathers everyone together, all the people, brings them to the temple, says, all the leadership locally and across the country, meet me. We're going to talk. And there the king read to them the entire book of the covenant that had been found, in the Lord's temple. He's like, guys, I found something. You need to read it. And the king himself, can you imagine this? His teleprompter was the scroll of Deuteronomy. He's like, oh, here's the words. And the king, what an epic moment for the nation, for the king to be reading the law to all the people gathered. In verse 31, the king took his place of authority beside the pillar, and he renewed the covenant in the Lord's presence. He pledged to obey the Lord by keeping all his commands, laws, and decrees with all his heart and soul. He promised to obey all the terms of the covenant that were written in the scroll. Why? Josiah is too late. That covenant was old. The nation broke it. The prophet, Huldah, she already told you that it's unsalvageable. The covenant has basically been broken already. Why bother obeying it now? It's too late. Just enjoy your good life. He said, nope, I'm going to obey this thing with all my heart and all my soul for all my days. Verse 32, he required everyone in Jerusalem and all the people of Benjamin to make a similar pledge. The people of Jerusalem did so, renewing their covenant with God, the God of their ancestors. So Josiah removed all the detestable idols from the entire land of Israel and required everyone to worship their Lord, their God. And throughout the rest of his lifetime, they did not turn away from the Lord, the God of their ancestors. Now, a couple things I won't read because we're reading a lot today, but I'll tell you about that he does above and beyond. For one, he goes over to some shrines that King Solomon, remember King Solomon, who was epic ancient king? But at the end of King Solomon's life, Solomon turned away from the Lord because he had like 1,000 wives or concubines, 1,000 wives or others, significant others, and he worshiped all their gods and built shrines to them along the way. And apparently other good kings have come along and have removed some of those kinds of places and reformed a little bit, but no one had ever removed Solomon's shrines because they were Solomon's shrines, you know? They're historic landmarks. If Solomon put them, he was epic. But Josiah's like, I don't care how historic they are. If it's bad, it's bad. We're going to get it out of here. We're not going to leave that monument. So he cleans out. He cleans out even Solomon's stuff, finally. And he goes up to the northern, what used to be the northern kingdom, which is now just the land of Samaria, and he goes to where the first king of the north had built a couple altars. Remember the first king, when the kingdom divided at the beginning of Thrones, the first king of the north was Jeroboam. And he made two golden calves to worship instead of God, and he put altars for both of them. And a prophet had come along to Jeroboam and said that one day a prophecy was that a child named Josiah would destroy that altar. Well, here we are hundreds of years later, and sure enough, a child king at the age of 8 is now an adult who goes up to the north and destroys that altar and fulfills that ancient prophecy. So, I mean, Josiah's cleaning house. And again, it's too late, Josiah. Why are you going through all the trouble for a losing cause, the nations beyond repair? But he did his part. 2 Kings, go back, 2 Kings 23, 21, let's continue. King Josiah then issued this order to all the people, hey, you must celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God as required in this book of the covenant. So the Passover to the Jewish people to this day, to the Jewish people, Passover is like Independence Day to us, like July 4th, except for it's a lot more important to them because we celebrate, a war we were about to fight for freedom. They were coming out of literal slavery. So it's a big celebration every year. It's their biggest thing. And so they had lost sight of why and how they did that because, again, after a while, the book of the law was gone. They had traditions, and most things become tradition after a while, which may become outdated or may shift or whatever. But they lost the original intent, the why behind the what. And so Josiah says, now that we found this book of the covenant, we're going to do Passover the way it was originally intended to be done. And sure enough, in verse 22, there had not been, this is kind of shocking, by the way, there had not been a Passover celebration like that since the time when the judges ruled in Israel, nor throughout all the years of the kings of Israel and Judah. Never in the entire history of the kingdom did they do their Passover celebration like they did this time. Not even during King David's epic reign or Solomon's. Like not since before they were a kingdom, back when Samuel and the judges were around. It has been that long, but Josiah, it says in the next verse, but in the 18th year of King Josiah's reign, this Passover was celebrated to the Lord in Jerusalem. Josiah also got rid of the mediums and psychics, the household gods, the idols, and every other kind of detestable practice, both in Jerusalem and throughout the land of Judah. He did this in obedience, again, to the laws written in the scroll that Hilkiah the priest had found, in the Lord's temple. Again, it's too late. And then the next verse is pretty cool. This is like the epitaph for his large tombstone. This is the eulogy. This is the summary of a life well lived. You want a great summary for a life well lived? Check out Josiah's in verse 25. Never before had there been a king like Josiah. This is so cool. Never before had there been a king like Josiah who turned to the Lord with all his heart and soul and strength, obeying all the laws of Moses, and never has there been a king like him since. There wasn't too many kings since, but anyhow, that's another story. He was epic. It's a dying gasp, but he's truly an amazing king. And that brings us to, we're going to skip ahead. He does all these repairs. The temple's restored. The nation's in its best spot ever. Josiah is now 39 years old. He's on top of the world. Things are going so well. Again, epic, epic leader. Deserves way more attention than we gave him today. But now we're going to read the end of his story. And it's our last thing we'll read today before we make some application and go home. 2 Chronicles 35. After Josiah had finished restoring the temple, King Necho of Egypt led his army up from Egypt to do battle at Carchemish on the Euphrates River, and Josiah and his army marched out to fight him. There's a lot going on there. Let me give you a little context, okay? Egypt had been a world power for a long time, but they were sort of a fading world power. Meanwhile, to the east of Israel, Assyria had been an emerging world power. They've kind of peaked now, and they're going to start declining. And Babylon will be the next emerging world power. But Egypt was still around, and they still want to expand their territory. So they sent their forces the direction of Judah and other nations to go to battle against somebody that no one's clear where they're going. But they just see that Egypt is coming with an army. So according to the understanding of the context, several kings or groups of people gathered together to try to form a battle front against the Egyptians. And among them was Judah and King Josiah. And they come out to meet. Now, I'm sure Josiah had a lot of tension towards Egypt in his young life. He had read about how that their people were once enslaved in Egypt. He found those books of the law. He'd been reading about God's deliverance. So here's Egypt coming their way, and he goes with others to face them as they march their direction. But look at verse number 21. But King Necho sent messengers to Josiah with this message: "What do you want from me, King of Judah? I have no quarrel with you today. I'm on my way to fight another nation, and God has told me to hurry. Do not interfere with God, who is with me, or he'll destroy you." Egypt's like, look, we know who you are too. He singles out Josiah. He's like, what are you doing here? I don't have a beef with you. Go home. We have our history. It's ancient. Just go home. And he says, I'm doing what God told me to do. I'm going to fight a battle God told me to fight. Well, Josiah does not believe him. Why would Josiah believe him? In Josiah's great-grandfather's life, Hezekiah's life, once the Assyrians showed up to their capital, and the Assyrians are like, hey, God told us to conquer you. You know? No, they didn't. So people love to throw God in the face of Judah because they cared about what God thought. They would use God against them. So here's king of Egypt saying, God's told me to go do what I'm doing. You're in my way. And Josiah's like, I don't even believe you, man. That's nonsense. I don't believe that. Verse 22, but Josiah refused to listen to Necho, to whom God had indeed spoken. Whoops. And he would not turn back. Instead, he disguised himself and led his army into battle on the plain of Megiddo. Now, if that sounds familiar, if that last part of that verse is like, Arlen, I think we've told the story before. That sounds like some deja vu. It's not, but I'm going to tell you what, there's a very similar story to this one that we have read before a couple months or so ago. I want to remind you, okay? Remember that we're talking about a divided kingdom, the north and the south. The northern kingdom was never as good. They were always kind of on a downward track spiritually. The southern kingdom was better. But in the northern kingdom, who was the worst king of the north ever? Remember? Worst northern kingdom ever. Ahab. He was the worst of the worst. He was the baddie. And so Ahab, the worst of the worst, one time wanted to go to battle against the Arameans, just like, well, down south, Josiah wants to go to battle with the Egyptians. But when Ahab wanted to go, again, Josiah is different than Ahab. Ahab is the worst of the worst. Josiah in the south is the best of the best. Very different people. But here's the similarities, okay? Ahab was warned by a prophet that God did not intend him for this battle to go well. He shouldn't go. And Josiah was warned by the king of Egypt, why would you listen to him, that he should not go to this battle to go home. And Ahab up north, terrible Ahab, he didn't listen to the prophet because why would he listen to a prophet of the Lord? He didn't care what God had to say. He wanted to go do what he wanted to do. Josiah, a very good king, why would he listen to the king of Egypt? What would he know? Understandable, right? So he's going to go to battle anyhow. So what did Ahab do up north way back? Remember the story? What did Ahab do? He disguised himself and went to battle anyhow incognito. What did Josiah just do? He disguises himself and goes to battle anyhow. And what happened to Ahab in the story? Remember the story? The similarities are weird. Ahab goes into battle and some random archer shoots an arrow and hits him and mortally wounds him. And he yells, hey guys, take me out of the battle. I'm badly wounded. And they take him away and he dies and is buried. And what happens to Josiah is so eerily similar. He's going to battle anyways in disguise. And check out what happens in verse 23. But the enemy archers, weird. The enemy archers hit King Josiah with their arrows and wounded him. And he cried out to his men, take me from the battle, for I am badly wounded. It's so weird how similar the story of these two very different kings ends. So they lifted Josiah out of his chariot. They placed him in another chariot. Then they brought him back to Jerusalem where he died. He was buried there in the royal cemetery, and all Judah and Jerusalem mourned for him. 39-year-old, amazing king, who started at the age of 8 and did a great job until he left way too early. And before I make some application here, I'm going to read just one more verse here, and then we'll, verse 25, the prophet Jeremiah composed funeral songs for Josiah. We've not met Jeremiah yet, but we're going to meet him in a couple weeks here. I love Jeremiah. I can't wait for that conversation. He's one of my favorites. The prophet Jeremiah composed funeral songs for Josiah, and to this day, king's choirs still sing these songs, these sad songs about his death. So apparently it was country music because it was sad songs. They still sing these songs about his death. These songs of sorrow have become a tradition and are recorded in the book of Laments. So we'll stop the story for today. Now, before I make my application, and we'll be done in a few minutes or so here, let me just say something about what comes next. Are you ready? Next week, Josiah's our last king. He's what a great way to end. He's the last one we're gonna spend much time on. There's a few more kings in Judah. We're gonna kind of brush over their very short and terrible reigns. And then next Sunday, we're gonna see the end of the southern kingdom, just like we saw the end of the north. Next week is the end of an era. Don't miss that. This whole mini-series will be finished. But the last king we'll spend significant time on is Josiah, and what a king to spend time on. So as we wrap up this story today, let me just talk about that for a bit. Josiah, best of the best, died the same way that Ahab had died years earlier, worst of the worst. Very different men died the same way. Isn't that weird? See, we can read the story of Ahab dying years earlier and say, do you know why Ahab got shot and killed in that battle up north? Because he was a wicked man who got what was coming to him, that's why. Okay, is that why Josiah died too then? I'm just asking a question. Is that why Josiah died too then? See, Ahab got killed by an archer in battle in disguise because he was a bad man getting what was coming to him. Okay, is that the same thing true for Josiah? Well, no, that's different. Okay, I agree. But isn't it human tendency to want to look at things that happen and say, that happened to that person because they're bad, right? Or that happened to that person because, listen, please let me make this statement. It's not on the screen, but please hear me. You can't always extrapolate people's character from their circumstances. Are you with me? You can't always extrapolate people's character from their circumstances. It's so easy to say, well, I know why that happened to that person. Uh-huh. Because they had what was coming to them. Really? Are you sure? Especially if we don't like them anyhow. If it's someone who's famous, maybe they're a political figure we don't like, or a famous celebrity we don't like, or maybe they're just someone in our personal life that they're the ops, you know? And we're like, well, bad things happen to them because they had it coming. Be careful. What do you do when it happens to someone you, what do you do when it happens to you? Or someone you think is a good person, or someone you like? Be careful that you don't extrapolate people's character based on their circumstances. Because that's not how it always goes. I mean, Josiah and Ahab, were they the same people? Not at all. Same ending? Absolutely. Can we just step away from the edge of our micro focus on people we like and don't like and people we know and why we think what happens happens? Can we step back from that edge for a minute and look at the big picture? Do bad people always die early and painfully, and do good people always live long and prosperous lives? In your own life, is that your experience? Is that what the history books tell us? Macro picture, is that how it goes? No. It's not how it goes. We all know people who lived long, terrible lives of money, long lives of terrible people who lived long lives, and they were rich to boot. We've all known people who were awesome. We thought they were great, and something happened to them, and they struggled through life, but they died early, or something happened. But it's not the opposite's not true either, right? It's not like Billy Joel once saying, "Only the good die young." That's not true either, right? I mean, sometimes bad die young. There's no rhyme. What did King Solomon once write in Ecclesiastes? He said, "Time and chance happens to us all. Things will happen in a broken, sinful world. They have nothing to do with someone being a good or bad person. Car accidents will happen. Storms will come. Disease strikes. Stuff, that's life." Be careful not to extrapolate people's character off of their circumstances. It's easy to do. It's arrogant, really. But we want to say, well, that happened there has to be a reason that happened. This is not a Christian problem. This is a human problem, whether you believe in anything or not. But Christians should be better at this because we have better instruction, I think. That we should never look at someone and say, I'll tell you why that happened to them, uh-huh. I'll tell you why that happened to our country. God's judging our nation. Really? You know that? God told you? Oh, yeah, he told me. It's so arrogant, isn't it? Like, how do you know that? You know, we are arrogant and we sit in the place of God declaring judgment on why things happen because it fits our narrative and we want to believe it. Instead of saying, I don't know. The problem with doing that to anybody, and by the way, remember Jesus' story? We haven't got to Jesus yet. We're getting there soon. Jesus was walking around doing his awesome Jesus stuff, and his own disciples were like, hey, Jesus, here's a blind guy whose sin was committed that make him be born blind, his sin or his parents' sin. And Jesus is like, what? That's stupid, man. What are you talking about? God's going to be glorified in his life, but no one's sin. Stop talking silly. But that's human nature to say, this happened for a reason, and I have an opinion on that. But those opinions are not only unhelpful, they're dangerous and they're arrogant, they're misguided, and we are not God. We don't know what happened. Things. If you do that, it eventually comes around to you. Be careful that you don't declare a sentence that might be true in your own life or someone's life you care about one day, judging why things happen to people. Why did Josiah die like Ahab died? Younger than Ahab. Why did Josiah die at 39 this way? I don't know. Can I offer you a reason? Here's a possible reason I'll give you. Maybe it's because the nation of Israel, the nation of Judah, was about to come to its demise. And God wanted Josiah out of the picture because he wouldn't want to see what was going to happen to his nation. So by letting him come to an early battlefield, story ending, the nation's still intact. He has a big funeral. Everyone mourns his death in Greece, and they celebrate his life. They write songs about him. And he leaves with the kingdom still in good shape. And not have to live to see what's about to happen afterwards. Maybe God was just getting him out of this world into a next better place before the bad stuff went down. Right? Maybe that's why. I don't know. Here's the thing. Say, Arlen, is that the reason? I don't know. And you don't know. Listen, you don't know. So don't act like you know. Right? In anyone's life, whenever you see, I'll tell you where that happened. Be careful. That's dangerous. That's arrogant. You don't know. So don't act like you know. And yeah, I see it sometimes. And it's so, just humble ourselves. To say, when people go through some bad things and you see someone, whether you like them or not, don't like them or know them or don't know them, Don't play God. When something bad happens to somebody else, the best reaction from us should be a humble one to say, oh, wow, I am so sorry that happened. Can I be of help or not? Either way, I'm just going to do what I should do, and I'm going to stay humble and leave God to do what he does. That's above my pay grade. And just care to help people as I could help them. You don't know, so don't act like you know. Here's what we do know. Here's what we do know. Josiah was an epic king. Like, if there was a Mount Rushmore in Judah, in Israel, Josiah would be. How many have been to Mount Rushmore? Have you been to Mount Rushmore and seen in person? Anybody here? Okay, we had more people in the first hour that had been to Mount Rushmore than we do in the second hour. Get with your game, second hour. Come on now. Mount Rushmore, okay? How many have been to the other side of Mount Rushmore, seen the backs of the presidents, huh? No, I'm just kidding. There's nothing there. Anyhow, I've been to Mount Rushmore. It's a beautiful sight. If there was a Mount Rushmore in Israel, Josiah would be on it. David would probably be on it. David would definitely be on it. Who else would be on it? We could argue that, debate that. But I think these two would be on it. Josiah was epic. He was thrust into power very early in life at the age of 8. He figures out, tries to do right. He figures out that it's too late for his nation, that they've gone so far that the end is coming one day, but not during his lifetime. He can't save his kingdom past his life, but he tries anyway. He's like, you know what? It might not make a difference, but I'm still going to do the right thing. Josiah, why waste your time? Here's the whole landing point. Don't miss it now. Josiah, you can't change the outcome. Why try to do the right thing? Why try to keep the covenant now? It's too late. Just do your thing and live your life. And Josiah's like, no, I'm going to do what's right, even if it doesn't make a difference, because it's the right thing to do. And folks, that is greatness. Greatness is doing right no matter the outcome. Don't miss this. This is my takeaway for today. Greatness is doing right no matter the outcome. Greatness is saying, if I practice my behavior in my business or my personal life in an ethical way, I might lose an opportunity or not get ahead the way I want to. But if I can do something a little unethical and shady, I can preserve myself and meet my goals and reach my dreams. And hey, you know, maybe it's not right, but once I do that, then I'll be in a position to do some good things from there. No, it's never right to do wrong in order to get a chance to do right. But it's tempting to justify the outcomes that we would like to manipulate or to say, hey, I can't make this work out anyhow, so why try? But greatness is in saying, I'm not doing what I do to get the outcome I want to get. I'm doing what's right, because it's right to do. And here's the thing about that. The outcome will be good. Maybe not the good that you and I want to manipulate it to be, but in the grand scheme of the bigger picture than we tend to look at, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. We know that there's a purpose behind it all. We know that in the end, Josiah's story is pretty epic. We're celebrating it today still, 2,500 years later. He's an epic king, even though it didn't change the story of what happens next to the nation. So in the outrun, you know, it does matter. The outcome is good. But outcomes are in God's category, not yours. That's why we shouldn't judge other people's outcomes. You don't know, so don't act like you know. But when it comes to your life, we can't manipulate our outcomes, but we can do what's right regardless of the outcome. We can do what's right even if doing what's right will make us miss an opportunity we want to manipulate or will maybe even harm us, we think. Greatness is doing what's right no matter the outcome. And listen, you don't have to be a king for this to apply. Are you with me? You don't have to be a king. All of us have opportunities every day of our lives to say, am I going to do the right thing or the thing that will get the outcome I want to control? And if those two things are the same, great, but if they're not the same, we are governed by what is right above all else. And all of us in that way, all of us can be great. Let's pray.